On April 14th, 2014, in a small town named Waseca, Minnesota, I may or may not be pronouncing that correctly, a woman looked out her window and saw something strange. She saw a young man walking across her yard toward a storage facility location that was adjacent to her place of residence. Several things struck her as odd about this. The young man was dressed in a long duster jacket, which has certain connotations in our culture. He was walking across her yard instead of on the sidewalk. That seemed a little bit odd. He was walking through puddles instead of walking around puddles. That seemed odd. But more than anything else, she said to the police later on, he just looked off. It was just something odd about the way he looked. By the time the police caught up with him and checked out what was going on, he was standing in the middle of his storage facility, which was full of cardboard boxes that were themselves full of machinery and paraphernalia and such that proved later to be bomb-making stuff. And after a brief time of resistance, he wound up basically telling a very elaborate story to the police, that he had a very elaborate plan to attack his school, kill a lot of people, kill his own family first, and go out in the blaze of glory, that kind of thing. I'll not use the young man's name. He was 17 at the time. I could. It's a matter of public record. You could research this if you wanted to. But the thing that struck the police, and later on the FBI and other organizations, that was odd about this particular story was that the young man did not seem to fit any of the preconceived notions that people had about school shootings. He was not obsessed with violent video games. He played them, but he wasn't especially obsessed with them. He wasn't a listener of loud, violent music. Thought it was stupid. He got, you know, decent enough grades. He didn't hate his parents. He thought his parents were fairly good parents. He thought he lived in a fairly decent town. He was really only had, he wasn't on medication. He wasn't diagnosed with any kind of mental illness or anything like that. The one thing that was rather remarkable about him and somewhat unusual is that he was obsessed with school shootings. He thought that Eric Harris, the organizer of the Columbine shooting, the kind of the patron saint of school shootings, he thought he hung the moon, thought he was amazing, wanted to be like him. And without getting a whole lot of psychological details about why that might be the case, why somebody would want to do that, suffice it to say for our purposes that this case lent very much credence to the idea that we are now in a culture that is not necessarily characterized by violence being the effect of other causes. There is a case to be made now in the 21st century that violence is the cause, that we live in a violent culture because we live in a violent culture. Simply being exposed to these things makes these things more likely. They generate themselves. The article that I was reading about this pointed to a study that was done by a professor at Stanford named Mark Granovetter, another name that I'm probably butchering. And I'm not an expert, and I'm not even suggesting that he's an expert, but it makes a lot of sense to me anyway. His theory is that violence is all about thresholds. It's not so much a matter of how bad is society at large. It's where is the individual. There are certain people, like Eric Harris, for instance, who have a threshold of zero. They do not need an excuse to go shoot up a school or whatever. They don't require a stimulus. They only require an opportunity. And there are other people who are a little bit more engageable than that, who require crossing a few more thresholds than that. And on the far end, you've got the 100-degree threshold where somebody is caught up in a riot, for instance, and, well, everybody else is stealing TV sets and setting fires. I guess I'll do that too. When it seems like the whole world is given over to violence, it becomes very easy for ordinary people who under normal circumstances would not do these things to get caught up in it. One of the things about this particular case that I found especially interesting with regard to thresholds, he told the police that he had determined months and months in advance that he was going to stage this attack in the month of April. He decided that was the best month for this kind of thing. But he was caught on April 29th. And he was not caught trying to bomb his school. And when questioned about this, he got very defensive and came up with one excuse after another. Well, there was timing wasn't right, and I thought maybe the all kinds of things thrown out there. And it very well may be, the truth of the matter is, he didn't really want to shoot up his school. He needed another push. He was one threshold short of an attack. And he kept putting up excuses, and maybe if he had a buddy, maybe he'd had somebody there, hey, what's the deal? Are we going to do this or not? Then he would have done it. But he didn't. And I say all that, and I wanted to spend a little bit of extra time setting the scene here, because I figured that this lesson was going to be too long for just one part. So I wanted to spend some extra time talking about this aspect of our violent culture, where violence becomes our family. Realize that we can create an environment, especially for our young people, not exclusively young people, but especially young people, who are craving family, who are craving inclusion, who want to belong. There are ample opportunities in our culture to belong to the wrong family. That you can be welcomed into a society where this is what you do. And an ordinary 17-year-old who under normal circumstances would never do these kind of things has not been positioned by his family, by his church, by his whatever to automatically exclude this kind of thing. Or at least he hadn't been put in a position where he is going to do that. And here given opportunity to do a really horrendously bad thing. Maybe you'll do it. I keep waiting for these breakdowns of the school shooters or the mall shooters or whatever. He's, you know, come from a broken family, or he's on medication, or he's a terrorist in training or whatever. I keep waiting for somebody to say, and an avid churchgoer. Because I can't, without being too cynical about this, I can't help thinking that if that were the case with one of these people, we would have heard about it. And I don't actively research these things. I could be missing something. But I've never heard of one of these. It may be relevant that the young man came back about a year or so before this incident, before his arrest, suddenly claiming to be an atheist. Which brings us to the point of living in a godless society. We're not suggesting here that everything was hunky-dory before our society largely embraced atheism. That's not the point at all. We read a few moments ago from Proverbs chapter 1. Solomon, speaking way back in the day, you read Proverbs chapter 1, this idea about not giving in to these ones who entice you to go after blood, and that's gang warfare, that's terrorism, whatever hot phrase you want to talk about. That's what that is. Back 3,000 years ago, parents were still dealing with that kind of thing. This has always been the case, that lost souls will find community. One way or the other, they're going to find it somewhere. Obviously, it is the obligation of parents to provide that community in the home. I shudder to think of a home that doesn't at least try to do this. Yeah, maybe we have mixed results. Maybe we're not all that great at it necessarily, but certainly we want our children to feel welcome in our homes. Until they turn 27, in which case they're on their own. No, just kidding. We want them to feel welcome. And I would like to think, by the same token, that we as a church community would not only be welcoming to our own children, but also to the children of others, that our young people would welcome other young people, that we would find a broader community in our culture, in our society, where this sort of impulse, in theory at least, wouldn't exist. And when you are exposed, for instance, to violent video games, or you are exposed to tackle football, or you are exposed to violent movies, or whatever it happens to be that the stimulus is, whatever they're angry about these days, you're able to compartmentalize that. I'm not suggesting those things are necessarily good or necessarily okay or necessarily bad. That's a family decision. I had a slide on this that I was going to talk about, and I couldn't find any scripture to back it up, so I decided to just throw it away. You choose, make your own entertainment choices as far as this goes. But as we are exposed to those kind of things over and over and over again, the reason that I, as a father, don't worry about that kind of thing is because I know that my children were reared in an environment where they were taught that's what they do. That's what other people do. You find out that one of your friends is that kind of person, you don't be friends with that person anymore. You avoid that kind of thing. And if you feel like these influences, we talked a little about Dungeons and Dragons over at the Goblin's house today. If you feel like Dungeons and Dragons is pushing you toward violence, don't play Dungeons and Dragons. That's an easy call for somebody to make who loves God. For somebody who honors God, who is living in the fear of God. If you're not doing that, though, if you're simply looking for a place to belong, you may find out that you belong here. And that can put you in a position that you did not anticipate, that you were not prepared for as a 15-year-old, or a 17-year-old, or a 12-year-old, and that your parents certainly weren't prepared for. And you wind up in a position that is far beyond anything you possibly could have imagined. There is a very real sense in which, I don't want to overstate this, but there is a very real sense in which the company that you keep defines who you are.